Hi, everyone. Thank you for staying tuned in. This is part two of our interview with Michael Tellinger and lovely Louise Clark. And they are here today to not only review the Ubuntu movement, but also some other really poignant questions that came up while I was reviewing his other book, which I'm not sure if everyone has seen this, but The Temples of the African Gods, which was a kick book. It's really good. So before we even jump into all of that, did you want to tie up in the research that you have done? Because Louise was mentioning, oh, you've got to talk about the research that you've been doing on the stone circles.
Yeah.
There's some new stuff that you were talking about.
I just will also mention that Slave Species of God has been republished by Bear & Co. in Vermont.
Oh, really?
And it has now got a new title called Slave Species of the Gods.
Oh.
So it's the same book.
Okay.
It's been edited and and fixed up.
Okay.
And it's got a really nice, you know, jazzy cover.
So it's just the cover that's changed?
Yeah.
Okay.
Content is pretty much the same, just some editing that they did.
Okay.
And Temples of the African Gods is a new version with more information.
Oh,
which is
cool.
Called African Temples of the Anunnaki. And it's a superb book because I think this book is pretty much out of print now.
What?
So you can get them as ebooks.
Okay.
But as far as physical form, I think this book has now become a collector's item. Temples of the African Gods. Yeah.
The other thing about this book that's kind of important is all the pictures.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really awesome to see the cymatic, you know, effect on the ground of each of the stone circles.
Yeah.
Because if you look at that, you can really see that they're playing different tones, like you were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, the other thing I wanted to ask you was, you had mentioned, we were talking about the Adams Column, you had mentioned that you had noticed that a lot of the ancient sites had been built on the golden mean spiral. Which other sites? Because you didn't really go into detail. I was just curious.
Well, they're not built on a golden mean spiral. Just all of them are built according to sacred geometric principles.
Okay.
And and they all seem to be on this earth grid that researchers know about. This earth grid that is, they're different grids that cover the earth, energetic grids.
Okay.
Some made up of pentagons, some made of hexagons, some made of dodecahedrons, and so it's a combination and a variety of these grids that cover the earth. And they have very distinct crossover points, these nodes, these very highly energetic nodes, and many of the ancient sites are built either along the connecting lines or on those very powerful energetic nodes. And that's important to note. So the ancient cultures, civilizations have built these sites, built them there for specific reasons, because they're very strong energetic points.
But also, if you were to map it out, you could do the spiral. You could draw out the spiral, and you would actually find them.
The spiral is at Adam's calendar. The reason I bring that up is because you'll probably find very interesting things if you draw a golden mean spiral from any ancient site and maneuver it around. You're going to find things connected to it that you previously did not notice. And that's exactly what I did with Adam's calendar. When we realized that there were pyramids in the valley aligned with Adam's calendar and that the pyramids are aligned with the rise of Orion's belt, I was just astounded because they look like pyramids from the mountain. Fortunately, unfortunately, when we were there, it was all misted in, so we couldn't see the valley. But on a clear day, they're like an obvious eyesore or an obvious beacon sticking out in the middle of this huge Barberton Valley. And wherever you go along the Adam's Calendar escarpment, they are right there. They like the main connecting point. And it's actually the pyramids that are in line with Great Zimbabwe and Great Pyramid of Giza.
Okay.
And I realized that they had to be connected. When you get closer to them, they still look very strange. They also emit weird energies. You lose GPS there the way you lose GPS at Adam's Calendar.
Okay.
And
is the configuration the same as that's in Egypt?
Yes, it seems to be. There are two large ones and a third smaller one. However, the Egyptian pyramids are not what we think they are, because there used to be a fourth pyramid in Giza, and very few people are aware of that. And that's a mystery that just unfolded a few years ago for me. It's like, oh, nobody ever talks about the fourth pyramid of Giza.
And where did it go?
Exactly. Where did it disappear to? So you know, just because they're two large ones and a small, that could be deception there. What I'm trying to say is that close by, that they don't look like pyramids. They're not built with blocks. They're these pyramidal shaped structures covered with soil, trees growing on them, rocks sticking out, but very much in a pyramidal form in the middle of nowhere. They're not part of the mountain range. Okay, so from a geological perspective, if you check on Google Earth even, you can see they're just offset off the mountain ranges that create, they like frozen rock. It's like from the impact, because the Barberton Valley is an ancient impact crater from a meteor strike billions of years ago. Billions, about 3.2 billion years ago.
Wow.
So the rocks, you start from the center impact point, you see small ridges of little mountains. It's like waves in a pond and you drop a pebble. They move away from the center. And the ones closest to the center are the smallest, and they get bigger, 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 and eventually you get to the outer rim, and that's where the big mountains are. But these two pyramids are not part of any of those rings of mountains going away.
Right.
Hills have become mountains. So that's already an anomaly.
We have noticed countless pyramids since we've been driving around here. Into Botswana, Zimbabwe, around South Africa. I was blown away how many pyramids. I mean, Sandy's constantly pointing them out to me.
Yeah. And then when I drew a golden spiral between Adam's calendar and the stone altar, and I extended it, it lands right between the pyramids. So basically you've got to ask yourself, what is the statistical probability that this is an accident?
Right.
Or that it's consciously done? And the answers to that are that, you know, several million or several billion to one, it's an accidental chance that it would have happened. So they must be connected.
So are you in agreement that it's some sort of energy creation device?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So there's no doubt. We've measured it, so... We don't even, it's not a theory, it's a scientific fact.
And then, now, is there any connection between that and the actual Enki's temple, where, you know, basically the Lulu was created?
Oh, so I thought you were talking about that. Well, they connected with a golden spiral, and that's the flow of energy.
Okay.
So they must be energetically connected, because energy flows in that spiral.
Very interesting. Thank you for that clarification. So now you've also said that there were very large communities of stone circles. Like they got, so you couldn't believe it. They just kept growing. You know, you were looking on the Google Maps. Mm-hmm. What's the largest ones you found?
The one here, where we are.
Wow.
We're right in the middle.
You're sitting in it.
Yeah. Waterfallboven, Machadodorp, 100 kilometers that way to Nasprate, 60 kilometers that way to Buckplas, and that way to Leidenburg, 70, 80 kilometers to Leidenburg. I mean, we're talking a diameter of, I used to say 100 kilometer diameter, it's 100 kilometer radius. So 200 kilometer diameter, it's more than 100 mile diameter. So, you know, just that alone, if you take away all the development, the towns, the forestry, the farming that destroyed much of it, and you can still see it on Google Earth where it's been destroyed, where you got circles and suddenly they stopped abruptly because there's farming land or forestry. So you know that they carried on in there. And you know, sometimes the circles are literally cut in half by a road. A road goes and they just put the bulldozer through it, and so that half a circle is right next to the road. You can see where the road goes through what used to be a circle.
That's such a shame.
And in Leidenburg, if you look at Google Earth, the last images are captured from Google Earth was all the new town suburbs that they're developing. Exactly the same is happening. You know, they come in, they flatten everything, they put in the streets, they lay them out, they put in the lampposts, and then they come and build the buildings. And when you look at these new suburbs that they're creating, you see the stone circles, half stone circle, a little bit here, then where they laid out the streets, and the stone circles are right among the streets.
It's amazing. And can you also clarify for the audience the connection between these stone ruins and the British colonization of South Africa?
Oh, well, first you need to define who the British ruling monarchy is. So, yeah, this is
okay,
a bottomless,
how would you define the
bottomless pit, you know? How far down the rabbit hole do you want to go?
That's true.
Exactly. So let's just keep it short and tidy. We talk about ancient civilizations here. It was predominantly about the gold. There can be no question about it because of the hundreds of thousands of gold mines that have been found. Okay, so it's about the gold.
Right.
If anyone still has any questions, well, what were they doing? It's about the gold. And then, mysteriously, in 1898, when the South African so-called Anglo-Boer War was launched by the British Empire against the Boer Republics and the people who wanted to be free in Southern Africa, there was a very sinister plot behind it, and it was obviously about the gold. But what people don't realize is, what gold are we talking about here? Because at that stage, the gold mines in South Africa, there were just a few gold mines. You know, the gold in Gauteng had just been discovered, like maybe 10 years prior to that. And so you'd say, well, there's just a little bit of gold, tiny little gold mines. And yet the British launched the most expensive war they have ever fought in the British Empire's history, against 60,000 farmers on horseback from two rebel Boer republics. Boer means farmer, okay? With a bunch of another maybe 60,000 to 80,000 African tribal fighters. And some of them fought on the side of the Boers, and some of them fought on the side of the British. And suddenly you got Winston Churchill involved in this war. You got Mahatma Gandhi involved in this war as a young stretcher bearer.
That was really strange.
And Paul Kruger involved in this war. One of the presidents of the two Boer republics. It was President Steyn and President Paul Kruger. And the British Empire sent 470,000 troops to South Africa in 1898. Now, put this into perspective. The total number of American and British and Canadian whatever troops in the Gulf War was about 250,000.
Wow.
470,000 British troops
on ships,
horses, hospitals, food, the supply system that feeds this machine, the weaponry, the cannons. Something much bigger was going on than people realize. Okay, and that bigger thing that was going on is that Paul Kruger suddenly became the most dangerous man in the world. And Paul Kruger to the British Empire, because Paul Kruger became immensely wealthy. And why did he become wealthy? Because he found something that only the British Empire, the royal political elite, that have knowledge of thousands and thousands of years, knew about. He found secret tunnels filled with gold. And they were not human tunnels.
Now, where? Where exactly?
Well, right here.
Okay. So it was right in this location. Mm-hmm.
So there's a story that on 4th of June, 1902, I think it was, a train left Pretoria. It was filled with gold. It was headed for Mozambique, for the port of Maputo, or Lorenzo Marques at that stage, Mozambique. That train was filled with gold. That train went missing. Now, to fill one train carriage of gold is a major feat, because that's a lot of gold. And
very
there were several carriages filled with gold that left Pretoria. It never made it to Mozambique. The train vanished in Machadodor, the town just before Waterval-Burfen. Remember, the Waterval-Burfen is Paul Kruger's town.
Oh,
and
okay.
Waterval-Onder is Paul Kruger's town. That's where his little house is, where he manipulated or controlled the war against the British troops. So there's a much bigger story to it here than people have ever realized. And we're right in the heart of it. Ancient gold meets modern knowledge, the greed of the British Empire. When they realized Paul Kruger had found the ancient tunnels filled with gold, they had to close and shut this down, and at all cost had to get rid of these rebels that suddenly had this wealth.
That's incredible. And I was talking with Chris and Sandy the other day about how amazed I was when they were talking about the history of South Africa. I said, hold on a minute here. This sounds like the United States.
Yeah.
And then we started comparing, you know, South Africa with Australia, with the United States. And I was thinking, well, we had covered wagons.
Yeah.
Well, we had atrocities when they were traveling out to the west. You guys had it to the north. Well, we had, you know, the fighting amongst the people, mm-hmm. you know, and the gold rush and all the people rushing there and then getting there and starving because there wasn't really any gold for them to find at the
And you can't eat the gold.
Right.
Yeah.
It just, isn't that interesting that three different continents and they all had almost identical history. Yeah. So people need to check that out. Okay, so the other question I wanted to ask you was about the agricultural terraces. And I did a little digging on the dolerite. It says it's formed when magma cools and solidifies igneous rock. But one of the things that they talked about was that it has an incredible ability to hold water.
Yeah, but also just remember that It is just another form of a granite. It's a kind of granite, and granite is rich of quartzite. Hornfelstone plus dolerite are metamorphosized quartzite. So it's all about the crystal.
Okay.
It's all about just various forms of crystalline substance.
But this particular, I thought you said this particular rock has the sound qualities that none other do.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, there are rocks around the world that will have those sound qualities. These ones just happen to be here.
You're
bringing rocks all around the world. And I suspect that they were used for the same reasons around the world. But here, it was, you know, I made the breakthrough kind of connection here, I guess. So, collecting these sort of long, elongated stones that, you know, look like French loaves of bread. And when you hold them up and hit them, they ring like bells. Many people have seen it, so that made me realize that we're dealing with sound and acoustic properties. And then I recognized the cymatic patterns inside the stone circles, and I started thinking, oh my goodness, it's all to do with sound. And then we got lots of other evidence, which we don't really have time to go into here, because that in itself becomes a two-hour discussion about why, how do I know, how can I be so sure? Well, there are lots of reasons why I can be so sure that these are cymatic patterns from the ground.
Well, and you've done an outstanding job just within those two books alone on documenting all of that data. So if you want to check out more information, don't forget that he's got the temples of the
African gods.
And
then also the new version of that, which is
the Anunnaki.
African temples of the Anunnaki. And it's got a different cover.
And then the other one is the slave species of the gods.
Slave species of the gods,
So check him out. He's done a lot of work. Okay. Another big mystery. Tell me, have you found why everything points to Orion? Serious people have talked about. But regarding the pyramids and the constellation alignments, what is your theory on that? For everything you've researched?
There are too many conflicting theories out there.
I know. It's very confusing.
But I thought we were going to talk about Ubuntu and constellations.
We are. But I just had that. And she has one question that's burning in her heart. She's talking about Credo Motba. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Okay. And he was talking about the Nilotic Meridian.
Yeah.
And that supposedly it's at 31.04 degrees longitude. But that should be the actual zero meridian.
That's what it
is. Do you agree with that?
It was that, yeah.
It was that. Okay.
And again, part of deception. Everything's been shifted. Everything's been moved. Wow. So if you keep the Nilotic Meridian as the Greenwich Mean Time, to explain that to people, everything changes. The whole energy of the planet changes.
And so if you take the 31 and turn that into zero, then everything else has to be adjusted accordingly.
There's some very interesting research around vortex fields, and that the I think it's Kosarev, Russian scientist. I think it was him. Forgive me for having a lapse of memory there. But he was one of the first people that started talking about the distortion of gravity fields around vortexes and vortices. And he found that they jump like in quanta in groups of 31. And so 31 becomes a very important number in a lot of numerology and mathematics and science and physics. It's fascinating that it was 31 degrees east according to how we look at it now.
Right.
So when they shifted it 31 degrees away from where it originally was. So remember, there was a reason why they did that. And again, they do nothing by chance.
Exactly.
Everything was always done for a very deep understanding of the laws of nature.
That reminds me that I need to double check on some of the work that we've done since we've been here.
Yeah.
Because everything was aligning on that one longitude. But anyway, okay. Ubuntu, Michael's like, finally! So, back to where we left off, which was, where did you begin? And you said it was just kind of one of those organic, unfolding daily things, right? So, what was the first step?
The first step was that we created what we called the Ubuntu Liberation Movement and started writing the philosophy on pieces of paper and on a website and putting it out there.
Can you give us some generalizations?
Well, reminding people that the country belongs to its people and not to the government. And that banks are private corporations and they do not work for the highest interests of the people. Benefit of the people, they're there to exploit the people, and really started a process of information and education of the people in every country, and specifically focusing on South Africa at that point, and then moving towards explaining how you don't need money in a society, that money is the trap, and that's what I learned from studying all this ancient stuff, that there was a time that money did not exist, and yet people existed for thousands of years without money.
Right.
And then suddenly you see this appearance of money and these first priest kings that suddenly started creating money out of thin air and making all the people their subjects over whom they suddenly took control. They became kings over people. Where did that come from? Who appointed them king? And you realize that kingdom was lowered to earth from heaven. The gods appointed the first kings and the priest kings on planet earth. And what did those priest kings do? They created money as a tool of enslavement. So there's a very simple line of evolution of where money comes from. And a lot of people still believe erroneously what we were taught at school, that money is just part and parcel of thousands of years of barter and trade, and eventually somebody turned it into a thing called money. No, that's a lie. So it's always been a tool of deception and tool of enslavement, maliciously introduced as a tool of enslavement. And then so we started putting out this information that we don't need money, we need people. People do everything, money does nothing. In fact, money becomes the hurdle and the obstruction to progress of people.
Right.
And that started to resonate with people. And then Kerry Cassidy came out here, it's 2009, and interviewed me and then said to me, you know, you should start a political party. And I looked at him and I said, you've got to be kidding. And, well, a year later we did. Just I realized that, because what we were saying was so radical, and that we need to do away with money and we need to shut down the Reserve Bank. Well, in some countries, including South Africa, that could be seen as treason.
Oh, yeah.
So, because you're undermining the economic stability of the corporation called Republic of South Africa. And you see, they write the laws because the corporations, and again, we have to educate people that the Republic of South Africa is not a country, it's a corporation. South Africa is a country, it's a landmass called South Africa, but the Republic of South Africa is the corporation that's taken control of the landmass called South Africa.
It's just America.
Exactly. So it's the same all over. And so once we started sharing that, I realized that let's create a political party, and then we can make these claims, and that becomes our political manifesto. So this is what we're going to do for the people. And then if this is what we propose to do as a political party, then we can't go to jail for that, because that's our manifesto. You can't, because it's freedom of speech.
Good
right?
Job.
And this is, so That's really our protection for this. And that's what we went with into the elections in 2007. On the 2014, on the 7th of May, we took this whole Ubuntu contributionism philosophy into the South African elections and promised to close down the Reserve Bank and create a People's Bank as an interim step, because we're ultimately moving towards a world without money. But you can't just yank the money out of the system, because that'll just cause total chaos. So what you first got to
make... And the programming.
Yes.
The programming with money is so deep.
Totally.
So deep.
And some people get it, some people take a while, but the whole philosophy of contributionism, again, for people that are new to this, is moving away from the use of money and the need of money. And how do we get there? To get from here to there, there unfortunately are some steps that we have to take.
Well,
and I know that Louise finds this frustrating because, you know, she's a far more evolved conscious being than I am, and she just wants to go straight to the top. And I keep having to remind her that you know, you can go to the top and you probably take a lot of very conscious people with you, but you're going to leave a lot of frustrated people behind. So let us take the lower conscious people like me by the hand.
Like me.
And I'll talk to them. I'll talk them through it, you know?
Too much. So tell us what happened with the elections. I really wanted to give you some airtime on that.
Well, it was actually spectacular. We went in with about 1 million followers.
You know, fantastic.
It was just unbelievable. The response we had and the following we had, you know, was beyond our wildest imagination. I didn't do a lot of TV interviews or radio interviews because we're a tiny party. And, you know, the big parties get all the media exposure.
Sure.
And yet it's supposed to be free and fair elections. And the national broadcaster is supposed to cover all the parties equally. Really?
Didn't happen to
no.
you, right?
No. So anyway, from the various radio interviews that I did, that still blows my mind today, is I had 100%, not 99.9, 100% support from all the callers to the radio stations.
Wow.
All the radio interviews that I did. That completely blew my mind.
Especially because that would have been the opportune time for
them
to diss you.
Yeah.
You
know? And it was so bad, the response was so positive, that the interviewer, the radio host was, well, everybody seems to like what you have to say. But, and then herself in the one instance, and then I can't remember if it was a male or a female in the other radio interview, because I had two major radio interviews. One was for an hour, other one was for half an hour, and that was pretty much it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so in the one, she was trying to come up with sort of, well, what are you going to do about, I got an email from somebody that said they emailed you in support, but you didn't respond to them to tell them how to join the Ubuntu movement. So how do you expect to run a country if you can't even answer an email?
That was
the best guy. So I said, hold on, there's a big difference between a small little organization who is overwhelmed by support, being able to respond email, to running a country when you get all the financial support that you at your disposal. So
perfect
don't confuse
response.
The issue here.
Perfect response.
You know, so that blew our mind. But when we went into the elections, what is totally overwhelming is that from 1 million followers and having to raise a lot of money, the equivalent of about $1 million in South Africa, 1 million rand that we had to raise, that we spent to run and have any kind of face on lampposts somewhere.
Okay.
We received 8,234 votes. So what that taught us is that the elections are far from free and fair, that they're completely and utterly corrupt, that the outcome is totally predetermined, just like in the USA, and that they just really put on this you know, dog and pony show for people to feel that, oh, look, I've put my cross down on the...
Right.
And also incredibly arrogant, because somebody, one of the vote counters for the IEC came to us and said, 2 days before they were, you know, while before they started counting the votes, if you get more than 8,500 votes, I'll take you to dinner. So really, when we got 8,200 votes, we were like, really?
How did you know that?
Exactly.
I know. But I tell you what really made us realize that something strange is going on. We were told by an observer at the international vote count, people outside of South Africa that voted. She turned around at one stage. Well, you know, at the elections, you got the screen and all the results are coming in, and all the political parties have their tables. And in front of us, I forget which political party, it was one of the smaller parties, which did get into parliament, by the way. They got enough votes. But one of the ladies, they turned around and said to me, you know, Ubuntu, I was quite surprised because I was an observer at the international vote count, and Ubuntu got the largest number of votes from international voters.
Whoa.
And I went, are you sure? I said, yeah, Ubuntu was the big surprise. They got the most number of votes. More than the ANC, more than anyone. 18,000 international votes were cast. So we were expecting, wow, if we got the largest number.
That's going to scale, right?
So we're going to think, well, we should get at least, like, probably, you know, 30% of the votes or 40% of the votes.
Right.
Out of 18,000 votes. Guess how many votes they allocated to us from international votes?
Oh, God, what?
Now, take a guess. Just take a guess.
Out of 18,000? 300.
28.
Oh, come on.
Yes. They allocated 28 international votes to us out of 18,000, and we got the largest number of votes.
That's amazing.
So you realize how crooked and corrupt it is.
You know, and I know this was hard because you're truly a pioneer. You're paving a way for a lot of others to follow. Okay, because I know this is the kind of stuff we're going to start running into more and more as we help dismantle the dismantling
the matrix.
You know what I mean? But does this dissuade you to do this again?
Of course not.
Okay.
So see,
this is what I love.
That was just invaluable experience and a deep understanding of how the system works. We are so much wiser and smarter. So why do you think we're focusing on a small town like Waterfallbuerfen, doing community projects, launching all these Ubuntu community projects? We've just launched 23 community projects, from uplifting and upgrading all the sporting facilities, a community hall, a food kitchen for the homeless, the orphans, the aged, a community gym, reestablishing the food, abandoned and destroyed food gardens, the fish farm.
Recycling.
The important, right. Feeding the homeless and the hungry, getting them on our side, making them realize that we together can make a huge difference. And I told you earlier how I'm astounded how people are gathering around us and supporting us in larger numbers every day. If I walk through town now and I drive into the township, people stop and wave and say, hey, Ubuntu! And 2 years ago, I thought it would be completely impossible.
Right.
So, 2 years from now, we get local elections.
And you'll be running again?
We'll be running again in this little town. There's, as we keep doing these community projects and then extend it to our neighboring town, there's a very good chance that we might win the majority outright vote here, which will make me the mayor.
That'd be awesome.
And guess what we'll then do? We'll implement the contribution philosophy with all the funding that comes in into this town. Slam dunk, home run. That's it. That's the tipping point. Because then nothing can stop us.
Well, think about it. 2016, that's a really good time.
Yeah.
Because I really, truly believe 2015 is the renaissance. I mean, the real, true soaring of the renaissance starting
and
next year.
That's interesting, actually, because I think it's people like Ashiana Dean and others saying 2017 is the big year of change. So if we get into the elections in 2016 here, really assert ourselves on a local, just, and I've been saying this for how long now? Every time I go do a talk about contributionism, forget about winning the national elections. That's not important.
Right.
You got to win one little, small, one-horse town.
Yeah.
That's where it begins. Because once you've converted and united that community, all the surrounding communities will go the same way.
Sure.
It's impossible for them to exist within the capitalistic model. They will collapse. They will have to start approaching and applying the contributionist philosophy, which benefits everyone. Because contributionism consumes capitalism wherever it finds it.
Yeah. It like collapses the whole belief system, doesn't it? So what is your next step? I mean, where are you now in your personal life as far as how involved are you with the Ubuntu movement here. Tell me a little bit about what is your daily life like?
I'll let Louise tell you.
Yeah. Come on, Louise.
It's a full-time, total love affair. Michael and I start early in the morning. He's now driving the community projects. So he gets up and he does that. He does some admin, goes out and starts activating the various projects with the coordinators in town. I come in, I work with the volunteers here, kitchen, restaurants, setting up education, all of that. And, yeah.
You guys are incredible. I just want to seriously honor you guys because I know how much work this must be.
Thank you.
And you deserve it, every accolade you can get.
Thank you.
And I honor the fact that you haven't given up, because I know you've been up against a lot of intrusion. And I don't know if you want to talk about that, but, you know.
Yeah, it's just, I don't want to delve on the dark or the negative side. But we were expecting it. I was expecting it. And you, the higher you go up the ladder, the more work you do towards, you know, light work you do,
absolutely,
the more you work for the benefit of humanity, the more
absolutely
you're going to get the detractors and the dark energies and the opposing forces trying to bring you down. So
right,
it's inevitable and it's expected. So I feel sadness for them. I feel deep sadness for them that they don't have anything better to do.
Well, I think the sadness is really more about the lack of empowerment within themselves.
Yeah.
That they cannot see beyond you and me and many, many others that are high profile that have been targeted, and they can't see through to our hearts,
yeah,
of how much we love them and we would do anything to bring this planet to peace.
And that's
proven it. We've proven it over and over. So, you know, some sort of statement that someone says is going to take hold of that, is going to erase all the work that we've done. I mean, come on, folks. Seriously.
What I'd like to just come back to, if I can, Alexandra, is just the integration of the community project and
yeah,
what do we want to achieve? Because I think a lot of people are still not quite understanding that.
No,
and a lot of people think that we're building a self-sustained community. And I need to tell you right up front, we're not creating a self-sustained community. We're not buying a piece of land and starting to plant vegetables for ourselves. That, I believe, is the trap that many people fall into. And I've been trying to explain to people, you don't need to start from scratch. Small towns and villages have all the infrastructure. You don't need to start anything. You have everything there. All you have to do is shift the people's mindset, make them think slightly differently and start working together in cooperation as opposed to in competition. So that's the huge thing. Don't try and run away from establishment. Use your town and the community that you have. You already have a community. The thing is that the community is divided. Unite the community, use the infrastructure, and you're light years ahead of starting from planting vegetables on some empty piece of land somewhere.
Right.
Right? So don't do that. I think that's the wrong way to go about it, quite frankly.
Well, the tools are already there.
Exactly. So right now, this is the plan of action, so that people really get a sense of what this, it's contributionism. We're converting this impoverished community with 70 to 80% unemployment,
wow,
orphans, HIV, young HIV mothers with HIV children, lots of homeless, unemployed people who have no money, no food, nothing. So taking that and converting it into a community of abundance. So how do we do this? And the community projects are the key. So we've identified the key and the necessary community projects. There are about 23 of them. And it starts, as Louise says, with recycling the rubbish dump, making sure we recycle everything, and go and take it to the guys that pay you some money for it. Okay, we can't go from zero to hero. We need to use money,
sure,
to free ourselves from the use of money.
Sure.
So we recycle everything. The money that we make from that, we pay the people that are recycling it a little bit so they can survive. They still need money to buy the odd things. But 50% of it then goes towards buying food for the community kitchen. The community kitchen that feeds the homeless, the orphans, and so forth. And everyone that participates in the community projects. That's the key thing. You don't just hand out food. You have to go and work in one of the community projects for 3 hours and then come and get your plate of food and a nice big glass of homemade lemonade.
See, that's important.
Without aspartame.
That's well, and that's really important because it gives them some fulfillment and value.
They wake up in the morning, they know they're going to go do this or bake bread or work in the dairy or go recycle, so they can do something different every day.
And they're learning new skills all the time. They have a sense of community, they've got people to talk to, they sit and eat together. It's just so, a different way of living.
And but it gets bigger. So now the community hall, the community hall that we're renovating, the vandalized community hall, as I mentioned, completely vandalized, that we're renovating, very soon we'll have electricity running there again, flowing, and water flowing water, which you already have, but a lot more work to be done. We need to fix the toilets and basins before we can open up. But that's where the community kitchen's going to be, right next to the community hall. So at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everyone that's worked in one of the community projects brings their ticket, gets their plate of food, they can watch a documentary for free in the hall, and at 7 o'clock we screen a movie, which they can also watch for free because they participate in one of the community projects. The people that don't want to work in the community projects will come and pay R5 to watch a movie, or R25 to get a meal and a movie. So the people that are lazy or not participating will actually fund the food for those people that are participating in the community projects. Now, the sportsmen, the soccer players, the cricket players, the rugby players, the netball, the basketball, the volleyball, and so forth, those people, because we're fixing their fields and we're making money available every week for them to play, they'll be working in the community projects fixing up the fields that they're playing on and the courts. So they then lead by example.
And by motivation.
Yes. But as you can see, this is a huge, huge, everything is integrated. Everything feeds into everything else. And so we need basically project managers and experts in every community project. For the little children, for example, right next to us, as you know, here we've got a huge open field. This is a cricket field and an athletics track that's completely vandalized. You can see people drive their cars there and spin their wheels. And you know, so we're going to close it off and turn this into the Little League soccer and the Little League rugby and the Little League cricket next door to us here. So we need coaches for rugby, soccer, cricket. And then right next to it, there's a huge concrete slab here that's going to be the seedling factory, where the children come in the afternoon, they watch a half an hour documentary on whales or stars or something, educational stuff.
Sure.
Then they come and plant some seeds. So we teach them how to grow food and grow seeds for an hour. Then they look after the seedlings from the day before and nurture and then, you know, write their name on the little jar that they planted in. So we make this an attraction to people that want to help fund these projects. They can buy a seedling from one of the little children. And so we're going to be working with orphans and the primary school children up to the age of 13. So from 5 to 13. And then when they finish planting seeds for an hour, they go play in the Little League. After which they take a little ticket and they go to the hall and get their food. And they go home with a full stomach. So it's that simple. Everything is integrated. So I get very upset when people arrive here and say, well, we also want to do some community projects, and they start doing something that doesn't integrate into this. Then they're basically dividing the efforts.
Right.
And they don't really understand what we're doing here. So I just want to be very clear for people around the world that want to do this. You can't have a bunch of people independently of each other doing community projects. That's a failure. That's going to fail. It's not going to succeed. Because as you know, sooner or later, it becomes just another drudgery. If it's not integrated, it's not going to work.
That makes a lot of sense, too, because reciprocity is such a core ingredient.
Yeah.
So one trade, so to speak, must be an advantage to the next, to the next. So it's, and it's really like a cell.
Yeah.
It's all integrating and working together for the ultimate goal.
So the other thing, so now the kids are planting these seeds, you know, within a month or two, some of the things grow quickly and we're going to have nice little trees and things. And then the kids are going to go and plant them in the town, along the paths, in the roads, in the parks.
Beautify
the city. And they become the protectors and the custodians of these fruit trees and nut trees and vegetable gardens that produce future food and prosperity for the community. And then the kids will protect them against the vandalous adults that, you know, have not yet built that consciousness up. So we, from an earliest age, we're teaching the children a love for Mother Earth, understanding how things grow, and putting them to implementing that. So,
and the connection with the earth. We've so lost that connection, and our children have too.
And the connection, and also how to grow food and medicine and herbs.
Yes.
What they're used for. You know, we need to bring that back, that knowledge.
Become more self-reliable. Yeah,
absolutely.
So Louise just mentioned the key word here, food and medicine. Yes. You know, coming from the pharmaceutical background, one of my passions here is to build this. If we clean this up, tile this up, this room here could become a little pharmaceutical production place, production lab, where we can use traditional healers, their knowledge, and the plants, aloes. You've seen how many aloes. We live in aloe land here, right?
Yes.
We can create aloe products coming out of our ears. So we can create natural shampoos, lotions, conditioners, mouthwashes, toothpaste, everything to do with natural hygiene that is not full of chemicals and poisons and that anything that you buy off the shelf. And so we make it in bulk here for the community, and the community just comes every month or every week just to refill their disposable container.
Right.
You don't throw anything away, you just come and refill it. And then it creates another interesting opportunity where you can package this and make it available for a slight profit to our neighboring communities.
Right.
And that brings in the revenue that we need to uplift and improve the projects. So every project that we have does two things. It provides that the produce or the product to the community for free or virtually for free. And the rest that we create, we make available at a fraction of the cost to our neighboring communities. And that's how you collapse their capitalistic model.
That's fantastic.
So, and what I forgot to say up front is that the model for contributionism is based on the Holy Trinity. We create three times as much as we need. And that's the thing. Self-sustained communities look after themselves. Mm-hmm. So think about what a self-sustained community really is. It's just a bigger version of my own ego. Instead of me, 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 it's now us, us, us. Let's protect what we've got from the terrible people outside the walls. Well, that's only going to last as long as the people start climbing over the walls to take from you what you've created and trying to keep to yourself.
Still in us versus
yes. So that's our contributionism. It's critical. It's creating abundance beyond your own needs and then making that abundance available to everyone around you.
Wow. Thank you for that. Because I really had not seen the clarity in that.
Yeah.
That is beautiful. So how about government?
What government?
The governing of the people. How do you keep the people from getting into it with each other? Or, you know, obviously there's an adjustment period of getting used to this way of life because of the programming that we've all been so significantly affected by.
Well, we are right at the beginning of this. As far as we know, this has never been done before.
I don't think so.
So we are paving the path as we go.
I
have no idea how this is going to unfold. We have a very clear vision. We know what we want to do. And we just go every day.
But I mean, have you talked about a council or a round table?
Yeah.
Because I know we've worked with that.
Yeah, what I was going to say is that with freedom comes responsibility.
Yes.
And we've been conditioned to give all our power away to government or a governing body or whatever, the teacher at school. We don't take responsibility for ourselves. We don't grow our own food. We do nothing for ourselves. And so we are absolutely helpless.
Yeah.
So if we want to free ourselves, all of us need to get involved, take responsibility for ourselves and the community. And that's what we need to do. But we've got a council of elders that we plan.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
So in essence, what Louise said, the council of elders that you alluded to is critical. And that's really becomes a new central decision-making body on behalf of the community, or the voice on behalf of the community.
Sure.
Because the municipality is certainly not the voice of the community.
No.
They're a political structure put in place by the elite from the central office, right? Central government. And they don't care about the community. You've driven around our town. You can see how they don't care about our community.
Yeah.
I mean, the streets are broken, nothing works, the town halls are vandalized, the fish farm is vandalized,
the water is
undrinkable, the sports fields are vandalized. I mean, and these are the people that we pay rates and taxes to every month. What's happening to all that money? So, in essence, what we've started here is, and you see, and this is why it's probably happening here, not in America or in England or somewhere else, because we still have probably a lot more freedom here.
Oh,
in
you
Africa.
Have a lot more freedom
and,
here.
You know, we can sell raw milk. You try and stop people selling raw milk in South Africa, people are going to look at you like, "What? What is raw milk?" You know, it's like it comes from a cow. It's milk. You know?
No, there's definitely more freedom here, and there's less electronic surveillance here.
Yeah. Well, maybe not necessarily as little as you think, but that's a whole other debate. That's a whole other debate. It's the point is this, that because of the sheer numbers of unemployed, homeless, starving, hungry people, we have a lot more opportunity to unite the people of need, people in need. The moment people look into your eyes and they trust you, they know that you're not just another politician that comes with lies and deception. The moment they look in your eye and they know, okay, these guys we can trust, and you show them a few of your actions that they can go, oh my goodness, these guys, really, we can trust them. You regain the people's trust, and you do this for a little while, those people will follow you in larger and larger numbers wherever you go. And that's really what we're doing here. Showing people that there are people out there with true honorable intentions to uplift the community. Not like all the government projects of upliftment and empowerment that come in here. It's all hot air, and after several years it fizzles out. It just causes more disruption because they plow the lands, they disrupt the roads, they dig up the water pipes and the electrical things under the pretense that they're going to improve and upgrade it and put in new, and then they just leave it and disappear with all the money.
Right.
So that's a repetitive story in South Africa.
But it's also not getting people to follow you. It's empowering people so that they realize this is their town.
Yeah.
This is their community. They need to take pride in it. They need to get involved and learn and take, you know, control for themselves.
It's really stepping back in time.
So in essence, what we started doing here is the town hall was open and vandalized. Anyone could walk in there, take anything. Okay, and I just went, well, if we leave this, there's going to be nothing left. So I made a few metal security gates, blocked off the entrances that people were getting in through, and started cleaning out the hall, step by step. I mean, it took a long time. It's taken us 3 months to clean that hall out and put security gates and get it to a point where we now have running water in the kitchen. Where, as I mentioned earlier, the whole kitchen sink was ripped out. It was there, the water was flowing everywhere, no taps anywhere, toilets ripped out. So now we got running water in the kitchen. We can use one half of the sink. We can use one toilet.
Yeah, you know, it's progress.
We're making progress.
Yeah.
We got some power and electricity in parts of the hall, and very soon we'll have the whole thing lit up, and we can open the doors and start using it as a hall. Now you united the community. They can go somewhere every day and do something. You've shown them that you really mean what you say you're going to do. And what we've done is we've taken a vandalized hall, and we've taken it back for the people. And I keep telling people that are getting involved with us, if it belongs to the municipality, it belongs to the people.
Right.
Because the municipality is the servant of the people. And if they buy anything with our money, then it belongs to us.
Very good.
So let's take the town hall and use it. So we're going to do this to all the abandoned municipal buildings here, including the fish farm, take it over piece by piece and start growing mushrooms in the one big hall, putting a boxing academy in the other, which we desperately need an enclosed place for the boxing academy, and so forth. So,
you know, I know a lot of people are thinking this. How are you overcoming the legal ramifications of going into an existing government building?
We're not overcoming it in any way. We're just doing it.
And nobody's stopping you.
No one's stopping us.
That's
and this is why it's I place so much emphasis on the support of the people and the support of the community, is that you have to gain the full support of the community, because if I trust that it's not going to come, it's going to be too late. If opposition from the municipality comes, then all the people are going to say, well, who are you? This is our hall. We have events here. We teach the children how to read. We do adult literacy classes. This is the soup kitchen for the community and the homeless and the AIDS orphans. What have you done for us?
Why do you want to close
Why do you want to close us down? This is where we feed the orphans.
Right.
It's they're not going to shut it down.
So they have something in it.
Yes.
And you're developing a sense of loyalty.
Yes.
That's beyond just, hey, here's a bowl of soup.
Yeah.
I don't, if I see you again tomorrow, you know, no biggie.
Yeah.
Nothing. With the soup kitchens that are existing
yeah.
now.
Well, it's not just a soup kitchen. Eventually, there'll be three meals a day. You know, I'll give you an example.
It's for the entire community. Really, you know, it's going to be incredible.
I'll give you an example. We just recently, on the way to Mozambique, when Louise and I took, we needed to take, you know, 10 days off or 2 weeks off, which we were going to lose our mind. And so we drove to Mozambique for the first time, right to across the border to our neighbor, beautiful coast, you know, just spectacular ocean. And on the way there, I kept saying to Louise, we must start a sawmill to cut wood for the people, because wood has become so expensive.
Yes.
People can't even afford to buy wood anymore. And by the time we came back, I manifested a sawmill. Remember we were talking about manifestation?
Yes, yes.
By the time we came back, within 3 days, we were offered a saw, 300,000 rand saw. You can't just buy that, we don't have the money.
Right.
We were offered a saw for a sawmill that cuts up to 6 meter tree trunks. Any kind of shape, size, planks, pillars, poles, anything you want. Offered a sawmill. And then 2 days later, we are offered tree trunks from a farmer down the road here who's about to cut down 20 hectares of blue gum forest.
Wow.
So, just like this. So, we're just preparing the shed where to store the wood. And this is going to become one of the, you'll see on the community project list. A sawmill is one of the projects. So, we just manifested it. Now we're going to be cutting the wood and making the wood available to the community for a quarter of the price, or at least half of the price that they can buy it in any other shop, which will bring us an income to the Ubuntu movement, with which we can then improve all the other community projects. But the big thing here is, as we discussed over lunch, is the electricity.
Yes.
Okay. The electricity is a big thing. We can't afford electricity anymore. I mean, I struggle to pay electricity. And we're not rich, but we're not unemployed.
Right. No, our electricity goes crazy as well.
I can't imagine how the people who don't have jobs or unemployed, how they actually survive and have electricity.
And if your electricity goes down, then they'll kick you out of your... They'll evict you because you're not with electricity.
Well, no, not really. It's just if you don't have money, you can't buy prepaid electricity. So you sit in the darkness and you can't cook. And in winter, you're very, very cold. Right?
Well,
so,
it's more about squatting and you know what it appears to be on the outside, and then neighbors getting concerned and things like that.
Well, the situation is slightly different here, but the point is that everyone needs electricity. All our community projects need electricity. We need electricity for the sawmill to cut the wood. We need electricity for baking bread. Our bakery has been standing empty for more than a year now because the woman that ran it as a community project couldn't pay the electricity bill. And so the bakery closed down. It wasn't necessarily a very good bakery, but nevertheless.
Yeah, but it's still a start.
We can't have a dairy without electricity. We can't keep the milk cool or make butter and cheese. Okay, so we need electricity.
So
we have found an alternative source.
I was going to say, what about a free energy?
So we have found more than one alternative source of electricity. And the community has now become aware of it.
Wow. Okay.
The word is spreading very quickly that Ubuntu has an alternative source of electricity. And this is, we've created a petition. So this is how we're handling the potential opposition from our municipality.
Okay.
We've created a one-page petition that spells out the community projects, that spells out how we're going to convert the fish farm, reactivate the fish farm, because we heard they want to break down a 20 million rand fish farm and put a shopping mall there.
Oh.
We're going to stop that from happening and reactivate the fish farm, because the fish farm will feed everyone in town and have hundreds of thousands of fish to export out of our town every month.
Right.
Bring loads of money into our community to upgrade the community with. But for that, we need electricity again. So the petition tells people about all these community projects, the petition that we sell the fish farm, and that we want the municipality to find an alternative source of electricity That's the petition. Everyone that has seen it, the reaction is, where can I sign? Can I sign it? That's the reaction. Even from very conservative white people in this town. Even they want to sign it. Okay? And we thought there would be an opposition. So, within 3 to 4 weeks from now, we're going to have between 4,000 to 5,000 of these petitions signed. We're going from house to house. That is pretty much an election document that will elect us into office if we need to. Because if everyone in our town has signed this petition, if 80% of the people, there's an overwhelming majority, we take that to the mayor. If the mayor doesn't respond, we'll start with legal court action. And any judge will say, well, the people have spoken. Why have you not done this? And we might even have a platform for a vote of no confidence in the mayor and replace him. And have a vote for the new mayor of the town.
Which would be you.
Which would possibly, most likely, be me.
That's awesome.
So who knows how this is going to unfold? We don't know. But from my knowledge of the legal system, I know enough about the legal system now with my actions against the banks, as you know, the highest paid lawyers in the world. Anyway,
really?
We're talking about guys that get paid salaries that boggle your mind. You know, one day's work.
That you worked with.
Half a day's work for an average person, annual salary for half a day's work. You know, it's like, you got to be kidding me.
Tell them a little bit about that.
Well, that was just when in 2010, I started to resist the bank's harassment that I was 2 months in arrears on my mortgage because I was traveling overseas and whatever. And I just thought, why are you harassing me so much? I'm not going anywhere.
Right.
I'm paying the thing. And then my friend Scott and I started talking about the free man, the sovereign man, and that was when I started getting into it, a straw man.
Yeah.
And I realized that something wrong was with the whole banking system, and I thought, I'm going to test this. Because it wasn't the house that I was living in, fortunately. It was a home that I bought on spec from Plan as an investment. I thought it would be an investment. Anyway, and I wrote the bank a letter, and I said, I want to see the original documents, and I'll see this and this and that, and they just said, sorry, we're not going to give it to you. Just like that. They're not giving it to you.
So what did you do?
I'm not kidding you. It was like, no, we're not going to give it to you. So I went, well, now I'm going to pay you. Now I'm going to pay you any more money. Unless you show me these documents, I'm not going to pay you. Unfortunately, you lose that battle very quickly. So before I knew, I was in court against the bank. And I had to go and defend myself against non-payment. And I had to learn all about how the banks work, the securitization, that they don't actually own the property anymore because they've sold it on and they have no right to act against you. But it was a process. In the beginning, I was very green and I learned. I went to the University of Life of teaching myself.
Our jobs.
Standing there defending myself against the highest paid lawyers and advocates in the business in the Supreme Court in Johannesburg. Not just in some local regional court. Only advocates, the guys in black robes are allowed in there. Right?
Yeah.
They're a higher form of lawyer in South Africa. And after 3.5 years in the court, the only way they could beat me is by coming up with a fraudulent judgment against me. Fraudulent judgment that was pre-written by the judge and obviously handed to him by the lawyers of the bank.
Unbelievable.
Standard Bank, the largest bank in Africa.
Standard.
And any bank, any company with the word standard in it must be a Rockefeller company. Just
you
a little
found
hint.
That out.
Yeah, well, Standard Oil, Standard Bank,
right,
you know,
right,
so.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. So what?
So I lost that. I lost that. Obviously, the house was auctioned, and I was ordered to pay sums of money to the bank and to their lawyers, which I then did. Louise and I drew up a promissory note, and I learned a lot of stuff in that process. Became very wise. I drew up a promissory note, and I paid the bank about the equivalent of $500,000, and which they have now accepted. I haven't said anything in a year and a half now.
Expensive and, lesson, but you got it off your back, basically.
And
you learned a lot.
But I've learned a lot. So right now, the banks probably think twice before they come after me because they don't want Michael Tillinger, who's the head of the Ubuntu Party, because, you see, then it'll get far more media exposure now.
Yes.
And they really don't need that kind of exposure. So who knows? So I'm using that knowledge with the petition and with getting the people behind me here. And if the mayor doesn't respond, you give him notice, right? You've got 21 days to deliver an alternative source of electricity. If not, we're going to take the necessary steps to implement this for the people.
So that's kind of going back to common law, you know, and that's really where we need to be.
in some ways, it's really uniting the people, and then using the legal system they've created against us, using it against them.
Right.
And then what happens? So this is how I see this. We know where the plug is to unplug the current supply and plug ourselves in.
Okay.
It's literally going drink and plugging us in, and for the whole town.
Whoa.
First we need to get a lot of our ducks in a row, right? It's not just
We need to be prepared for this.
But
this is gonna end up on the newspapers around the world for sure.
But in essence, the people need to know that we have access to free electricity. And in return for 3 hours a week, in any one of the community projects, you get free electricity, uncapped free electricity. Because the machine, there's no cap on the machine.
Right.
It produces 1.2 megawatts of electricity. It's much more than we need in this town. So the excess will be put back into the grid, and Eskom, the major supplier that supplies 45% of Africa, continent of Africa, 45% is supplied by South Africa's Eskom. They're huge.
And then they buy it back from you.
They pay you for it.
Yeah.
Now, they don't advertise that, but they do that when the situation occurs.
Right.
Because they... it's a long story. I don't want to digress, but Eskom does really nasty things in South Africa. They have a thing called load shedding, where they tell a town that we don't have enough electricity, so certain towns in South Africa are going to have to go without electricity for a few hours. And they warn you in advance, or a day, say, Wednesday and next week you're not going to have electricity. So prepare for that. Okay, so... So we can overcome that. The power never fails. There are other things that I don't necessarily want to talk about right now. We've got other energy devices that are just coming out of our ears. The whole energy thing is exploding around the world.
It's
connected to the level of consciousness.
Yes.
And it's only coming through now because the people's consciousness is reaching a level where we can accept it. We can bring it into our reality and not abuse it.
Yes.
We use it for the benefit of the community. And this is key. And I've got to stress this. And I know that I'm rattling off like a... But this is... By creating a energy device that you give every person in their home, that's not the solution.
Okay.
Okay. Because then you're actually dividing the people. And it becomes, again, me, me, me. I'm okay. I run my household on my own electricity device. My power is not going to go down, but my neighbor will. Okay, so what we're promoting here is an energy supply that can supply the whole town, not just individuals. So you use the electricity supply, the free electricity, as a tool of unification to unite the people. A tool to unite the people. Everyone can have free electricity, but you have to contribute 3 hours a week. 3 hours a week towards one of the community projects. Why? Three is a Holy Trinity number, so we like to work with that.
Right.
3 hours a week. Think about the number of community projects we have. Let's say we end up with 50 community projects, right? And we have 3 hours a week. We have 5,000 people in our town. That's 15,000 hours a week. 50 community projects, 15,000 hours a week. We don't have enough community projects for the people to work in.
Yeah.
Can you see? We already have a problem.
Right.
So that means that the abundance we'll create. There's so much bread, so many bridges, so much food. We'll have too much stuff because all these people doing stuff because we have free electricity.
Fantastic. And you said I was just going to ask you, there's about 5,000 people?
Yeah, between 4,000 and 5,000. It's difficult to say. Between 4,000 and 5,000 people.
What? Why here? I mean, I know you had Stone Circle, so you've done research. Why this place?
Because this is where we are. This is where the Ubuntu movement was formed,
okay.
Was created. This is where he wrote the philosophy.
We live here.
And we live here.
This is our community. So
yeah. I'm just curious.
It makes sense to start in our community.
Yeah.
And also, we're here because of the ancient civilizations.
Yeah.
So there's a strong resonance here. And I can tell you, ask Louise, for 7 years, I've been here for 7.5 years, this has been like a black hole of sucking energy. Because whatever dark forces are preventing us from getting off the ground here, they know once we succeed here, it's game over. It's slam dunk, home run, game over.
No surprise that it would be in South Africa, which is the you know, the First World Age, it's primordial, one of the primordial nouns. I mean, it's just not a surprise that this would be the beginning of this movement.
Yeah.
Well, so did you have anything else to contribute as far as going into any other ideas about Ubuntu? So I know you're the woman behind it all.
No, just that we're going to continue, and we are very excited about all the support we're getting around the world. We feel very blessed. We're watching other communities growing now in Canada and Australia and the United States, and it's really helpful.
Where in the United States?
All over. There's a huge Ubuntu movement in the USA. And Canadian Ubuntu movement is just really strong. They're really registering the party. The UK Ubuntu Party is being registered. In Australia, I think they've started that process.
Yes.
In Germany, in Austria, the Ubuntu movement is being, I'm not sure how far they are, but Professor Franz Hormann, you know, the leading professor of economics at the Vienna Institute of Economics, I think. He is the guy behind Ubuntu in Austria.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So, in essence, what we've done is we've planted the seed of consciousness. They're growing themselves. We can't control the whole thing around the world. But what we need to control is the clarity and the purity of the message that goes through. We can't allow the rogue elements to infiltrate the integrity of what we're doing.
Right.
It has to stay as clear and as focused as the original message. And we've seen already that there are people that are trying to undermine it, use the Ubuntu logo and the name and so forth to try and sell dubious products and stuff like that. So what we have been trying to create as quickly as possible is a platform where all the accredited or affiliates of Ubuntu are on. So if you're not on our accredited affiliate website, then you're not an official accredited affiliate of Ubuntu and you're doing your own thing. And you're a rogue element and you're dividing the effort. So it's really, really important for people to say, don't think that because you think you understand the philosophy, you can run off and do your own thing and call it Ubuntu and contributionism. That's going against the grain. Communicate with us, make us know that you're setting something up, you'd love to represent Ubuntu and contributionism in your area, start working with us, get as much information for those that are creating political parties. All the documents have been written. And when we get to the politics, we want the political message to be the same in every country.
Yes.
Obviously, slightly skewed for the specific conditions of each country, but the message needs to be the same. I don't want to see political parties, Ubuntu parties getting up in other countries and going with radical, wild messages,
yes,
which that is not going to be supported by us here at the Ubuntu head office.
Which could ultimately lead to separatism, you know,
yeah,
that you don't want. I want to read this off to the people. This is part of their manifesto, our inalienable rights, the rights of all citizens. One, the country belongs to its people. Two, the land belongs to its people. Three, the water belongs to the people. Four, the forests belong to the people. Five, the rivers and lakes belong to the people. And six, the gold, the platinum, diamonds, chrome, copper, iron, uranium, tin, aluminum, and all other minerals in the ground belong to the people. Seven, the air and the air waves belong to the people. I just got goosebumps on that one. Eight, everything that grows on the land belongs to the people. Nine, the beaches, the mountains, and the skies above belong to the people. 10, the wild animals do not belong to us or anyone else. They belong to the planet, right on. And we are their custodians and protectors. And 11, the earth is our mother. We are only here because of her, and therefore we must honor her and protect her against harm. I mean, I almost started crying when I read that.
Well, that's the sort of manifesto of the Ubuntu movement in general. The political party has a slightly different manifesto, which people can get on our website, which goes into, you know, what will we do when we get into power?
Right.
And if I'm elected president, first thing we do is close down the central bank. We close down the reserve bank and replace it by a people's bank that issues money for the people,
yeah,
by the people, tax-free, interest-free, free of any levies, taxes, or fees payable to anyone. No interest, no inflation.
Yeah.
The money is created by the people for the people, so that people can do everything and anything every community needs to do.
Right.
That's what that money will be for.
Right.
Okay, and that's just you can imagine what that does to the psyche of the people. Suddenly, everyone who lives in any city anywhere, stuck or in the fear of leaving the city to move to a small town or the mountain somewhere because they don't like to live in the city, can move and do that. Why? Because no matter how small the one horse town is, the bank that belongs, the people's bank in that town, will make money available for all the community projects they need to do for their community.
Yes.
Can you see how that changes everything?
Completely.
So it makes you realize that money is should be used as a tool for abundance for the people. Right now it's being used as a tool of enslavement.
Exactly.
And the moment you start using money as the tool of abundance, very quickly people will realize, well, okay, well, great, now we're going to the bank, the people's bank, to get all this money to build the roads and the bridges and plant the food. And after a few years, they'll realize, well, why do we keep going to get the money? We know we're going to get the money for everything we need to do, so let's just leave the money out and let's just do it. So it's a process, a slow process of realizing that we don't need the money, we need each other.
Right.
So there are two manifestos. One is the sort of Ubuntu manifest, contributionism manifesto about people, our rights, the rights, inalienable rights of living, breathing human beings, and not citizens, as that's an old document. I still refer to people as citizens.
Ah,
okay.
Yeah.
And remember, this is a living document.
Right.
It changes all the time.
Right. Yeah.
And for the political party and the political elections, we had a 7-point manifesto where we speak about the bank, as I said, and then supporting the scientists on all levels, making money available for exploration, deep discovery, developing free alternative energy devices, supporting the farmers, creating laboratories to undo the Monsanto GMO stuff so our scientists can fix the problems that Monsanto created, support the sports, support everything, arts, culture, support, you know, purify the water, provide alternative electricity. So there's like 7-point mantra for the electioneering, if you want to call it that, for the political platform.
Right. And it also lists here the people that are needed to support the Ubuntu movement for Michael and Louise are cooks and chefs and bakers, barmen and women. I love that. Barmen/women. let me see. Builders and handyman, carpenters, plumbers, electricians, organic farmers, food growers, artists and crafters, IT, which is always essential, and graphic designers and all other skills.
And especially now as well, sports facilitators, healthcare givers, doctors, nurses, physiotherapists,
teachers,
and then sports facilitators, soccer trainers, soccer coordinators, basketball trainers, people that love training kids basketball, tennis, all the sports. We need those people to come as volunteers and work with us for a few months in the very beginning as we start these community projects off the ground. Very soon, we're going to have 300-400 children a day playing sports every day, from tennis to volleyball to basketball to cricket to rugby to soccer. Somebody's going to have to be there to coordinate. Louise and I can't do that.
No.
You know. So, and this is when we say we need help in funding. And people say, well, what are you doing? Well, these are the things we're doing.
Yeah.
And we need to be able to feed these people when they come here as volunteers. We need to be able to feed the volunteers actually pay for themselves. We work on $30 a day for accommodation and food, right? So most people can afford that for 2 months.
Yeah.
And most of them, would actually be cheaper for them to live with us for those 2 months than it is living at home.
Yeah. No kidding. That's a good deal.
So basically all the community project leaders to take care of all these things on a daily basis. This is a huge operation we're starting, and as far as we know, this has never been done before.
That's fantastic. Well, wow. I just want to thank you so very much. You guys have been outstanding to talk to today, and thank you for working it out that we were able to finally meet in person.
Yeah.
And thank you for coming.
I'm so honored to be here in South Africa. I just love it here. And I just want to ask everyone to please check out Michael's site. And he also has michaeltellinger.com. That's one of them. Ubuntuparty.org.za. And what is the other one?
That's it.
Those two?
Those are the main ones.
Okay. So if you have any questions, please, you spread the light across the world. You make the difference. We are here to support you. I am so honored that you've done this much work for all of us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We love you. Truly love you.
Thank you.
We love you too. Thank you. You guys take care. We'll see you on the other side of the world next time.